Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Okay, so we're going to be very gauche now and we're going to talk about money. Economist David McWilliams, good morning.
Brendan, how are you?
And your new book is called Money, A Story of Humanity, and it is a story of humanity. It was Bono's idea, actually, was it, that you write this?
Well, actually, you know, it was a funny thing is that about 5 years ago, himself and myself were sitting at the back of Finnegan's pub in Dalkey, and we were chatting about the economy and how it worked and where money came from and all that sort of stuff. And I was talking to him that I was thinking about this idea of how do you explain money to people? How do you explain economics to people and how do you make it? And he had been listening to a podcast of mine, which was talking about this particular dilemma. And he just said to me at the end, he said, well, write it down and see what you, I suppose. And I suppose that's the thing about, you know, Bono, you two, they're kind of doers.
They
do things, you know.
If you
could imagine, why did four lads from the north side of the Dublin become the biggest band in the world? Because somebody said amongst them, it is possible.
Yeah.
Just do it. Don't sit in the pub chatting about it. Go write it, do it.
Okay. And you did.
And
right?
I did.
And now, in one way, we all think about money a lot, but we don't actually kind of think about what it is or question any of that.
Exactly.
And money, you point out, is really just this imaginary concept, like a story we've all kind of agreed to buy into.
It's, you know, what struck me, Brendan, is over the years, I suppose this is a book that I've actually probably spent about 20 years thinking about writing, because most of my career, I started years ago as an economist in the central bank, where basically money is created for the state. And then I went on to investment banking, who push credit into the society. And then, of course, I came home and documented, as you know, the boom and the credit boom and the banking and the housing prices and what was going to happen. And I thought, hold on a second, there's something odd here. Then we had the crash, then we had austerity. And so it struck me that my entire economics career, Brendan, has been defined by the relationship between us humans and this bizarre thing called money.
Yeah.
And
it is central to everything.
Everything. If you think about everything, you can't conceive of or imagine the world we live in now without money. If you look at it, it's kind of like what I describe, it's like a universal language. So there's people in, let's say, New Delhi, okay, and there's people in New York, and they don't know anything about each other. They can't speak each other's language. They don't know each other's religions, cultures, anything, but they both speak the language of money. So it has this universal idea, and it kind of struck me, I said, hold on a second, why is it that every single way of organising human society, be they religious societies or communist nirvanas or feudal societies, have gone by the wayside? But the one organisation for society that has remained absolutely at the forefront are societies organised around this thing called money. So what I decided to do, Brendan, was, okay, let's go back and see. So it's a history book. It's an anthropological book. I've read all sorts of stuff to try and understand humans and money. So you go back and see, where did money first start? And you see that money first started about 5,000 years ago in Sumer. So Mesopotamia, which is now Iraq. And then you see money emerges at the same time as counting, as numerals, as writing, as law, as religion. Ironically, you were talking about religion, as organized religion. So it struck me, why is money co-evolving with all these things that we now regard as kind of central to the way humans live? And I got the idea that it's because when humans are faced with enormous complexity, loads of different relationships, they need an organization, a technology that organizes us. So it struck me, if you take that as the basic idea, and as you said, money is bizarre because it doesn't exist. It only exists in the human mind.
It's an idea, really.
So it only exists in the human mind. So it's not in the animal world. It's only in the human mind. So and it takes an enormous leap of abstraction to, for example, say, I'm going to Tesco's to buy a litre of milk. And the reason I know this, I bought one this morning, it costs €1.05. So I give €1.05 of a notional thing, and in return, I get a real thing. So this is an extraordinary mental leap that humans made. So what I decided...
And you'd say then, going on, that it's not just that money kind of was coexisted with these things. Money actually
animated
drove,
exactly.
drove so, everything. The Reformation, so, Renaissance,
everything.
All
so
of
I'll
it.
Tell you what happened. I'll tell you, during the boom here, what I was always intrigued by was what increase in house prices did to people. So economists in general, they see an increase in price and they see a number.
Yeah.
But the rest of us see an increase in price and we get a feeling. Okay?
So this is the trippiness of money, you call it.
This is the trippiness, right? So we feel something. So what is it doing to us? And then you understand that money is this extraordinary force that propels humanity forward, that animates people, that forces us to do things, and at the same time is everywhere and ubiquitous. So what I decided to do is look at various eras. So the Sumerians, the Greeks, the Romans, as you said, the Renaissance, the Dark Ages, the Reformation, Darwin, James Joyce, all the way up to Bitcoin. So yeah. From the Stone Age to Bitcoin, to see why at every stage in the innovation of money, there has been a huge flourishing of innovation in other areas. Why is that? And this is something that really...
There's one key thing that you identify, which I had never thought of before, is that money democratized society. Upward mobility. Before money, your place in the world, ordained by God, that was your place in the world.
And this really interests me, that money, why money is so attractive, is the promise of money is that if you can get it, you can change your own personal circumstances. And one thing really interested me, you talked about Christianity with Brian D'Arcy there. What has always fascinated me is why did Jesus emerge where he did and when he did? And what were the social forces around him? And one of the social forces around him, Brendan, was money. So the Greeks were the original amplifiers of money, right? And we forget that Greek was the language of commerce in Jesus' time, and commerce was an urban phenomenon, and Christianity is an urban phenomenon. And going back to your point about knowing your station, right? Prior to money changing Greek society, you think, why did the Greeks surpass all of the civilizations in philosophy, in architecture, in thinking about politics, in democracy? Was it because they had money and nobody else had, because of this democratic idea? And the second thing is, Brendan, if you believe in that idea that you can better yourself with money and you can in some way change the world, well, then the converse is true. If you don't do well, it begins to look like your fault. Right. So in the old society, you had your station, you were born there. Right. And so amazing. Christianity put the most unfashionable idea at the center of it, which was inequality. Now, why was that? Because societies were becoming more unequal even back then. So, you know, the financialization that's going on now about mass inequality, that was happening. So the reason that the message of Christianity, and I'm not a religious person, but I'm fascinated by it. Right. Was the opposite.
So it was the counter idea to money. Exactly.
Right, so
the idea and was just as potent.
Precisely.
And,
so the world had to come up with a countervailing ideology against the ideology of money, and they came up with Christianity, which may explain why it emerged, where it emerged.
Okay. Can we come to the modern era for a little bit? For an ex-central banker, you're fairly critical of central bankers in the book, but I suppose at the moment, the sense is that they came late to it, but have they now suffocated inflation without killing economies? No real recession yet, but then we saw mixed signals in Ireland this week. America seems to be getting a bit tricky.
Well, I think, you know, the reason I'm a little bit critical about central banking is it also struck me that economists in general, and like my own tribe, you know, if you talk to a plumber can tell you how water goes through the pipes. In the same way, economists can tell you how money goes through the system.
Okay.
But it'd be hard to pin a plumber down and say, why do we need water for life? Okay. Why do we need it? And I think that's what the book's trying to do, is go a bit broader. But to come back to the idea, right now, it looks as if a guy called Jay Powell in the United States, the head of the Fed, and basically because America prints the currency that the world wants, it's the only thing that matters in this game. Everybody else is in the halfway place, right? The US dollar, the US interest rates, all that sort of stuff. It seems that they are, as you said, kind of managing to negotiate this very, very fine line between too much inflation, too much unemployment, and they're in the sweet spot now. But what we know about economics, and we talk about this in the book, is that the economy is never at equilibrium, right? Equilibrium, this idea that economists say, okay, everything's fine. That means the economy is at rest. And we know that the economy never sleeps. It's always advancing. It's always mutating. It's always changing. So I think in the case of Ireland, like what we have had is we have had 5 or 6 years of economic growth. It doesn't really matter what the number is. Go back to the idea of the feeling, right?
Yeah.
Irish people feel. What do we feel? Do we feel that we're getting richer? I'm not too sure.
Yeah.
Do we feel the
There's
place?
Certainly a generation
exactly.
there that feels.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so always, I think with economics, always come back to the feeling.
Okay.
Because the feeling is what makes us human. The numbers are something we measure, but the feeling is makes us humans, and humans make the decisions at the end of the day.
Okay, so what do you think are going to be the consequences? Is there a generation there, 20s, 30s, 40s, right? They got a raw deal after the financial crisis, then crash here. COVID hit them as well, a kind of a double whammy
yeah,
then.
Yeah.
You've got housing in the mix there as the maybe a fundamental of all that problem. What do you think, what are the issues that strike you around that generation?
Housing is the thing, right? That is the only thing. Ireland is about two really good decisions away from creating quite a brilliant society here. Housing is a big thing. But to come back to your question, look, you and I are the same generation. We, in the 1980s and early 1990s, could move out from our parents, could get a flat, maybe a room in a flat, right? Could live with boyfriend, girlfriend, mates, could begin the process of becoming an adult, leaving the nest, in effect. We could then imagine buying a flat to settle down. We could imagine having a kid. We could even imagine getting married. All of that in our 20s or early 30s. That process of adulthood has been shifted out maybe a decade in Ireland, okay? And that, of course, has a profound impact, to answer your question, on the psychology of the individual and the collective psychology of all those individuals, which is this idea, they call it, I think it's an unfortunate expression, you see it written, kiddledhood, that they're adults but children at the same time. But the reason, once you retard those events that mark the progress from being a teenager to being an adult, you create what I think is a very fragile society. And that is maybe the overwhelming reason that we have to fix housing, is because accommodation is about, it's not about economics, it's about kind of dignity. Are you a dignified person? Do you feel a full person when you go out in the street? Can you pay your rent? Can you live exclusively alone without being dependent? And that is something that we can fix.
What two decisions are we away from a great society?
Well, look, I've looked at the housing market. What's amazing is if you look at a country, the best thing about the new world we live in is you can look at other countries and see what they're doing. And the country that seems to have got housing right, believe it or not, is Singapore. A country that we regard, sometimes you hear about the models, right? We should be the Singapore of Europe. Right?
Yeah.
But what Singapore does is they did what Ireland did with council houses in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, right? The Singaporeans build houses. The state provides houses, private houses, for individuals at discounted prices, very low prices, so they get on the ladder. And then what it does is it says, off you go. You're sorted now. You can therefore build wealth, right? Because most Irish people, the only wealth we have is the house we live in. And there's a lot of people say, oh, we have to put everybody in rented accommodation, put this, that, and the other. I think, no, don't go against human nature. If human nature wants to build the wealth, allow people to do this by getting on the ladder. Now, ironically, when I lived in England in the 90s, there was this hangover of, oh my God, Mrs. Thatcher sold council houses. We've been doing that since the 30s, right? Very interesting thing here is that all Irish states built council houses for people to own and to ultimately create wealth. We've got to go back to that.
Okay.
So it's not like, Brendan,
so
it's
again,
not
it's
a
interesting, biggest, yeah. But it's like that, it's economists aren't taking into account this psychology, this
the psychology,
trippiness
it's
of money
everything.
And the feeling of that generation. Okay, listen, another couple of interesting things from the book that I want to get back to. You're fairly scathing about cryptocurrency. You argue it's not even money at all.
It's not money.
Given that money is only a made-up thing, is cryptocurrency not a made-up thing?
So one of the central points of the book is that money is about trust. And money is also a public good. And by that, I mean it's provided by the state. In the same way as the guards are provided by the state. You don't go to a vigilante as a general rule, right? So once you appreciate that, one of the fault lines in money is this fault line between private money and public money. So money issued by the state, which you can pay your taxes in, okay? And you believe in that concept. And private money, which is money issued by Brendan O'Connor, right? Okay, the Brendan O'Connor coin, right?
Right.
And basically what happens if Brendan O'Connor issues a coin like crypto guys, you get really rich, Brendan, because you issue it, right? So you own the printing press. So it's very clear. I just think that cryptocurrency isn't money as we know, right? It's almost like a lobby group that's trying to foist upon the world this idea. And the basic idea, money, if you can get your head around this idea, is a bit like language, right? The more you use money, the more effective it becomes, which is why the dollar is so effective, because everybody uses it. The English language is effective because everybody uses it. Crypto is like Esperanto. It's like the Esperanto of money, right?
Okay. It looks
great. And one of the reasons money is interesting, the same way as the English language is interesting, it's kind of, the English language has the worst grammar, right? Think about it, right? Bits stuck onto it, bits that don't make sense, etc. It is a mess grammatically. It is a mess to learn, but it works. Money is a mess, right? If you were to start again, you might do it differently, but it is what we have. Whereas the crypto is like Esperanto. It looks more pure. But actual fact, it's only a
buy-in is the key. And if buy-in hasn't happened by now, you...
It ain't going to happen. I'm back to human nature. I'm back to humanity.
Listen, something you're very good at is that you are always scanning the perimeters for what's next and those kind of invisible forces bubbling up that shape our lives for the coming decades and stuff. And you're good at taking that overview picture, which you do in the book, and seeing the bigger picture. So people might have said now that the force is coming, crypto, okay, we've dismissed that. AI is the hot one. Obviously, the markets think that's where it's at. What do you see as the big forces?
Well, I also see, never look at the financial markets as predictors of the future.
Okay.
Right? Okay, just park that for a second, right? So once you see a massive boom in something, that doesn't mean it's all going to work. It means lots of fellas, are taking a punt, right?
Okay.
Okay. I think I don't know who said it years ago, demography is destiny. The idea of people matter. The statistic that jumps out of the world, and I mean the world most, and this will have a huge impact in Ireland, is last year there were more children born in Nigeria than born in the entire continent of Europe. Okay? Mm-hmm. So put that into your idea, right? That we have a population explosion in Africa, in certain parts of Africa, okay? We have a rapidly diminishing population in Asia, in China, and in Europe. So I would say the biggest force that you can predict, because the great thing about demography is you can predict, if you have a baby, you know they're going to grow up, right? This is something, whereas technology, you're taking a punt, right?
Okay.
But babies we know grow up, and babies in poor countries are growing up much healthier than they used to be. So I think the biggest force in the next 30 years is going to be the demographic force and the democratic reaction to it all over, let's say, our part of the world, in Europe,
right.
And how you manage this. I have no, there's no sort of inbox here that has an in-tray that has an answer. But I think this is the big one, because that we can predict, that we know is going to happen. Everything else is in the realm of speculation.
Are we kind of living out the last days of the Roman Empire here in our Western centric view of the world? That America and Europe, we rule the world, and the rest of them, well, some of them are catching up a bit, but basically we're still in charge.
Yeah.
Is that story?
I think that story. I mean, what was interesting about writing a book like this is I did a huge amount of reading about history, the role of money in history, and, you know, the Roman Empire being a great, great example. The Greek Empire being an example. The British Empire being much more proximate, and we know it. I mean, the British Empire in 1922, when we left, was at its peak. There were more people ruled by London than anywhere else ever, any other empire, right?
Yeah.
And now it's gone.
Yeah.
And it went like snow off a ditch. And I think there is a sense of, there's a very clear sense of an economic shift to Asia. Stuff has been made in Asia that isn't being made here anymore. And once manufacturing leaves, what I would call the muscularity of the economy changes. And I suspect that you're probably right. We are beginning the process of decline in the West. If you think about it, Europe and America together probably constitute about 10% of the world's population. 10% rarely dominates 90% for long.
Yeah.
So I think you've got to look at all these big things. And our...
And you don't know what's happening when it's happening, do you?
You don't know what's happening.
The Romans. You reckon a credit crunch could have been part of the issue that finished off the Romans?
It's a fascinating story. Yeah, look, I was reading lots of stuff by the Romans. This is, I know it's almost a meme. Yeah, men, yeah, middle-aged men reading about the Roman Empire.
They're sitting up in their chairs now.
Exactly. Yeah. But there was a big study done about 4 or 5 years ago on the various reasons given for the end of the Roman Empire. And there were 219 specific reasons which historians gave. And one of them not given was the collapse of Roman money, the collapse of the currency. They devalued, so much so that at the end they could only print the emperor's face on one side of the coin. So soft and malleable was the coin because it was literally devalued, less gold.
Going back to now that what you say about Africa and everything, you paint a picture two of the most successful places in this book. Trieste is an example you use, right? Places that are open, diverse, cosmopolitan. I think you call it places with no past and places that aren't obsessed with the past. Places that are in the now, I guess.
Yes.
This diverse, liberal, open kind of mix.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was all about... I was fascinated by James Joyce opening a cinema here. That amazed me, right? So in 1909, James Joyce opened the Volta Cinema in Mary Street, okay? And that intrigued me and I really studied it, and I actually studied it for a contribution to a book just to mark the centenary of Ulysses. And then I thought to myself, the mind that wrote Ulysses was also the mind that set up this first cinema. And is there some connection between literary, artistic self-expression, and what I call commercial self-expression? What types of people take these risks? What types of people do this sort of stuff? And what you see is the types of people who take these sort of risks are very, very similar. The artistic mind and the commercial mind, even the individuals, are very, very similar, right? Because they don't want a boss. They don't want a wage. They want to create the new. They want to actually invent something completely new that didn't exist yesterday. And they're prepared to stand on what I call the public stage of opprobrium. They're prepared to take all the slagging because inside them somewhere they believe it.
Okay.
And Joyce, the entrepreneur, and Joyce, the artist, were one and the same thing. And then you think, what sort of societies have a preponderance of these sort of individuals? It's societies that allow dissenters, disruptors, people who stand away from the crowd to flourish or live a peaceful and accepting life. And that is why somewhere like Trieste, at the beginning of the last century, which was cosmopolitan, new, was accepting refugees and all sorts of people, Joyce being one of them, created this extraordinary flourishing of commerce, of art, of literature, one piece of which was Ulysses. And New York City is the same. You know, if you
we
go
like
around,
to think we became that kind of a place in recent decades, open, liberal, forward-thinking, all of that. Are we that place now, do you think?
I think the overwhelming evidence is we are, still. I think if you look at... I remember years ago, you probably the same, Brendan, friends of mine went to London, New York, never came back. And we were always thinking, I wonder why your man never came back. Because he was gay. Because he couldn't come out in the early 90s. Now people can come out, they can be whoever they want to be. And in that sort of sense, I believe that there is a direct link between the liberal and opening up of Ireland and the economic renaissance that we experienced in the last 20, 25 years. It's part of the same process. And you see it, the book goes all the way back to the Dutch Empire of the 16th century. You see the same thing happening in Amsterdam in the early 17th century, in London, all the way through. Because basically, I come back to this, people make the economy dance. Not capital, people and ideas. And the type of people that make the economy dance tend typically to be the type of people who kind of say, I want to do it myself. And that's the sort of the society that allows those sort of people to live emotionally, sexually, in any way. That type of society tends to be rewarded with an enormous upswing.
Is that a society as well that needs a lot of migration into it?
It's a society that needs a certain amount of migration. The issue of migration is economists talk about numbers, but you get people. So let's come back to people, right? And people need to be housed, and they need to be fed, and they need to go, their kids need to go to school, and they need to go to hospitals. So the practical dilemma of immigration, I'm not sure is cultural. Some people do think it is.
Okay.
But I think it's actually about capacity. If we don't have the houses, the trains, the hospitals, you cannot continue to pour immigrants, because immigrants mean people, on top of it, because you'll get capacity. You'll get inflation. It's the economic equivalent of the Oasis tickets, right? Think about it. 2 gigs, lots of people.
Yeah. Listen, excellent stuff. I love a bit of blue sky, big picture thinking. And it's excellent. The book is, it's called Money, published by Simon & Schuster. It's in bookshops now. And you're taking the book on a live podcast tour, I know, from September 16th.
Absolutely.
To Dublin, Limerick, Galway and Cork. And that's yourself and John Davis.
Yes, that's the live podcast where we discuss the book.
Texter says, great to hear David's voice again. Lately, we were wondering where he went. He hasn't gone away, you know. Welcome back. Okay, David McWilliams, thank you very much.
Cheers,
we'll take a break.